Part 1, Chapter 4, Sections 5 and 6 of The Possessed by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Translated by Constance Garnett. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Expatriate in Bangor, Maine. Chapter 4, The Cripple, Section 5. The Lebyadkins' door was shut but not locked, and we were able to go in. Their lodging consisted of two nasty little rooms, with smoke-begrimed walls on which the filthy wallpaper literally hung in tatters. It had been used for some years as an eating-house, until Filipov, the tavern-keeper, moved to another house. The other rooms below what had been the eating-house were now shut up, and these two were all the Lebyadkins had. The furniture consisted of plain benches and deal tables, except for an old armchair that had lost its arms. In the second room there was the bedstead that belonged to Mademoiselle Lebyadkin, standing in the corner, covered with a chintz quilt. The captain himself went to bed anywhere on the floor, often without undressing. Everything was in disorder, wet and filthy. A huge soaking rag lay in the middle of the floor in the first room, and a battered old shoe lay beside it, in the wet. It was evident that no one looked after anything here. The stove was not heated, food was not cooked. They had not even a samovar, as Shatov told me. The captain had come to the town with his sister utterly destitute, and had, as Liputin said, at first actually gone from house to house begging. But having unexpectedly received some money, he had taken to drinking at once, and had become so besotted that he was incapable of looking after things. Mademoiselle Lebyadkin, whom I was so anxious to see, was sitting quietly at a deal kitchen table on a bench in the corner of the inner room, not making a sound. When we opened the door, she did not call out to us or even move from her place. Shatov said that the door into the passage would not lock, and had once stood wide open all night. By the dim light of a thin candle in an iron candlestick, I made out a woman of about 30, perhaps, sickly and emaciated, wearing an old dress of dark cotton material, with her long neck uncovered, her scanty dark hair twisted into a knot on the nape of her neck, no larger than the fist of a two-year-old child. She looked at us rather cheerfully. Besides the candlestick, she had on the table in front of her a little peasant looking-glass, an old pack of cards, a tattered book of songs, and a white roll of German bread from which one or two bites had been taken. It was noticeable that Mademoiselle Lebyadkin used powder and rouge and painted her lips. She also blackened her eyebrows, which were fine, long, and black enough without that. Three long wrinkles stood sharply conspicuous across her high, narrow forehead, in spite of the powder on it. I already knew that she was lame, but on this occasion she did not attempt to get up or walk. At some time, perhaps in early youth, that wasted face may have been pretty, but her soft, gentle grey eyes were remarkable even now. There was something dreamy and sincere in her gentle, almost joyful expression. This gentle, serene joy, which was reflected also in her smile, astonished me after all I had heard of the Cossack whip and her brother's violence. Strange to say, instead of the oppressive repulsion and almost dread one usually feels in the presence of these creatures afflicted by God, I felt it almost pleasant to look at her from the first moment, and my heart was filled afterwards with pity, in which there was no trace of aversion. This is how she sits literally for days together, utterly alone, without moving. She tries her fortune with the cards, or looks in the looking-glass, says Shatov, pointing her out to me from the doorway. He doesn't feed her, you know. The old woman in the lodge brings her something sometimes out of charity. How can they leave her all alone like this without a candle? To my surprise, Shatov spoke aloud, just as though she were not in the room. Good day, Shatushka, Mademoiselle Lebyadkin said genially. I brought you a visitor, Marya Timofeyevna, said Shatov. The visitor is very welcome. I don't know who it is you've brought. I don't seem to remember him. She scrutinized me intently from behind the candle, and turned again at once to Shatov, and she took no more notice of me for the rest of the conversation, as though I had not been near her. Are you tired of walking up and down alone in your garret? She laughed, displaying two rows of magnificent teeth. I was tired of it, and I wanted to come and see you. Shatov moved a bench up to the table, sat down on it, and made me sit beside him. "I'm always glad to have a talk, though you're a funny person, Shatushka, just like a monk. When did you comb your hair last? Let me do it for you." And she pulled a little comb out of her pocket. "I don't believe you've touched it since I combed it last." "Well, I haven't got a comb," said Shatov, laughing too. "Really? Then I'll give you mine, only remind me, not this one, but another." With a most serious expression, she set to work to comb his hair. She even parted it on one side, drew back a little, looked to see whether it was right, and put the comb back in her pocket. "Do you know what, Shatushka?" She shook her head. "You may be a very sensible man, but you're dull. It's strange for me to look at all of you. I don't understand how it is people are dull. Sadness is not dullness. I'm happy." "And are you happy when your brother's here?" "You mean Lebyadkin? He's my footman, and I don't care whether he's here or not. I call to him, 'Lebyadkin, bring the water,' or 'Lebyadkin, bring my shoes,' and he runs. Sometimes one does wrong and can't help laughing at him." "That's just how it is," said Shatov, addressing me aloud without ceremony. "She treats him just like a footman. I've heard her myself calling to him, 'Lebyadkin, give me some water,' and she laughed as she said it. The only difference is that he doesn't fetch the water, but beats her for it. But she isn't a bit afraid of him. She has some sort of nervous fits almost every day, and they are destroying her memory so that afterwards she forgets everything that's just happened and is always in a muddle over time. You imagine she remembers how you came in, perhaps she does remember, but no doubt she has changed everything to please herself. And she takes us now for different people from what we are, though she knows I'm Shatushka. It doesn't matter my speaking aloud. She soon leaves off listening to people who talk to her and plunges into dreams. Yes, plunges. She's an extraordinary person for dreaming. She'll sit for 8 hours, for whole days together in the same place. You see, there's a roll lying there. Perhaps she's only taken one bite at it since the morning, and she'll finish it tomorrow. Now she's begun trying her fortune on cards." "I keep trying my fortune, Shatushka, but it doesn't come out right," Marya Timofeyevna put in suddenly, catching the last word, and without looking at it, she put out her left hand for the roll. She had heard something about the roll, too, very likely. She got hold of the roll at last, and after keeping it for some time in her left hand, while her attention was distracted by the conversation which sprang up again, she put it back again on the table unconsciously, without having taken a bite of it. "It always comes out the same. A journey, a wicked man, somebody's treachery, a deathbed, a letter, unexpected news. I think it's all nonsense. Shatushka, what do you think? If people can tell lies, why shouldn't a card?" She suddenly threw the cards together again. "I said the same thing to Mother Praskovya. She's a very venerable woman. She used to run to my cell to tell her fortune on the cards without letting the Mother Superior know. Yes, and she wasn't the only one who came to me. They sigh and shake their heads at me, they talk it over while I laugh. 'Where are you going to get a letter from, Mother Praskovya,' I said, 'when you haven't had one for 12 years? Her daughter had been taken away to Turkey by her husband, and for 12 years there had been no sight nor sound of her. Only I was sitting the next evening at tea with the Mother Superior, she was a princess by birth. There was some lady there too, a visitor, a great dreamer, and a little monk from Athos was sitting there too, a rather absurd man to my thinking. What do you think, Shatushka? That monk from Athos had brought Mother Praskovya a letter from her daughter in Turkey that morning. So much for the knave of diamonds. Unexpected news. We were drinking our tea, and the monk from Athos said to the Mother Superior, 'Blessed Mother Superior, God has blessed your convent above all things, and that you preserve so great a treasure in its precincts,' said he." "What treasure is that?" asked the Mother Superior. "The Mother Lizaveta, the Blessed." This Lizaveta, the Blessed, was enshrined in the nunnery wall, in a cage 7 feet long and 5 feet high, and she had been sitting there for 17 years in nothing but a hempen shift, summer and winter, and she always kept pecking at the hempen cloth with a straw or a twig of some sort, and she never said a word and never combed her hair or washed for 17 years. In the winter they used to put a sheepskin in for her, and every day a piece of bread and a jug of water. The pilgrims gaze at her, sigh, and exclaim, and make offerings of money." "A treasure you've pitched on," answered the Mother Superior. She was angry. She disliked Lizaveta dreadfully. Lizaveta only sits there out of spite, out of pure obstinacy. It is nothing but hypocrisy. I didn't like this. I was thinking at the time of shutting myself up too. I think, said I, that God and nature are just the same thing. They all cried out with one voice at me, "Well now!" The Mother Superior laughed, whispered something to the lady, and called me up, petted me, and the lady gave me a pink ribbon. "Would you like me to show it to you?" And the monk began to admonish me. But he talked so kindly, so humbly, and so wisely, I suppose. I sat and listened. "Do you understand?" he asked. "No," I said, "I don't understand a word, but leave me quite alone." Ever since then they've left me in peace, Shatushka. And at that time, an old woman who was living in the convent doing penance for prophesying the future whispered to me as she was coming out of church, "What is the Mother of God? What do you think?" "The Great Mother," I answer, "the hope of the human race." "Yes," she answered, "the Mother of God is the Great Mother, the damp earth, and therein lies great joy for men, and every earthly woe and every earthly tear is a joy for us, and when you water the earth with your tears a foot deep, you will rejoice at everything at once, and your sorrow will be no more. Such is the prophecy." That word sank into my heart at the time. Since then, when I bow down to the ground at my prayers, I've taken to kissing the earth. I kiss it and weep. And let me tell you, Shatushka, there's no harm in those tears. And even if one has no grief, one's tears flow from joy. The tears flow of themselves, that's the truth. I used to go out to the shores of the lake. On one side was our convent, and on the other, the pointed mountain, they called it the peak. I used to go up that mountain, facing the east, fall down to the ground, and weep and weep, and I don't know how long I wept, and I don't remember or know anything about it. I would get up and turn back when the sun was setting. It was so big and splendid and glorious. Do you like looking at the sun, Shatushka? It's beautiful but sad. I would turn to the east again, and the shadow of our mountain was flying like an arrow over our lake, long, long and narrow, stretching a mile beyond, right up to the island on the lake, and cutting that rocky island right in two, and as it cut it in two, the sun would set altogether, and suddenly all would be darkness, and then I used to be quite miserable, suddenly I used to remember, I'm afraid of the dark, Shatushka, and what I wept for most was my baby. Why, had you one? And Shatov, who had been listening attentively all the time, nudged me with his elbow. Why, of course, a little rosy baby with tiny little nails, and my only grief is I can't remember whether it was a boy or a girl. Sometimes I remember it was a boy, and sometimes it was a girl. And when he was born, I wrapped him in cambric and lace, and put pink ribbons on him, strewed him with flowers, got him ready, said prayers over him. I took him away unchristened and carried him through the forest, and I was afraid of the forest, and I was frightened, and what I weep for most is that I had a baby and I never had a husband. Perhaps you had one, Shatov queried cautiously. You're absurd, Shatushka, with your reflections. I had, perhaps I had, but what's the use of my having had one if it's just the same as though I hadn't? There's an easy riddle for you. Guess it, she laughed. Where did you take your baby? I took it to the pond, she said with a sigh. Shatov nudged me again. And what if you never had a baby, and all this is only a wild dream? You ask me a hard question, Shatushka, she answered dreamily, without a trace of surprise at such a question. I can't tell you anything about that. Perhaps I hadn't. I think that's only your curiosity. I shan't leave off crying for him anyway. I shouldn't have dreamt it. And big tears glittered in her eyes. Shatushka, Shatushka, is it true that your wife ran away from you? She suddenly put both hands on his shoulders and looked at him pityingly. Don't be angry. I feel sick myself. Do you know, Shatushka, I've had a dream. He came to me again. He beckoned me, called me. My little puss, he cried to me. Little puss, come to me. And I was more delighted at that little puss than anything. He loves me, I thought. Perhaps he will come in reality, Shatov muttered in an undertone. No, Shatushka, that's a dream. He can't come in reality. You know the song. A new fine house I do not crave. This tiny cell's enough for me. There will I dwell my soul to save and ever pray to God for thee. Ah, Shatushka, Shatushka, my dear, why do you never ask me about anything? Why, you won't tell. That's why I don't ask.
"I won't tell, I won't tell," she answered quickly. "You may kill me, I won't tell. You may burn me, I won't tell. And whatever I had to bear, I'd never tell, people won't find out." "There, you see, every one has something of their own," Shatov said, still more softly, his head drooping lower and lower. "But if you were to ask, perhaps I should tell, perhaps I should," she repeated ecstatically. "Why don't you ask? Ask, ask me nicely, Shatushka. Perhaps I shall tell you. Entreat me, Shatushka, so that I shall consent of myself. Shatushka, Shatushka." But Shatushka was silent. There was complete silence lasting a minute. Tears slowly trickled down her painted cheeks. She sat forgetting her two hands on Shatov's shoulders, but no longer looking at him. "Ah, what is it to do with me? And it's a sin." Shatov suddenly got up from the bench. "Get up." He angrily pulled the bench from under me and put it back where it stood before. "He'll be coming, so we must mind he doesn't guess. It's time we were off." "Ah, you're talking of my footman," Marya Timofyevna laughed suddenly. "You're afraid of him. Well, goodbye, dear visitors, but listen for 1 minute. I've something to tell you. That Nilitch came here with Filipov, the landlord, a red beard, and my fellow had flown at me just then, so the landlord caught hold of him and pulled him about the room while he shouted, 'It's not my fault, I'm suffering for another man's sin.' So would you believe it, we all burst out laughing. Ach, Timofyevna, why, it was I, not the red beard, it was I pulled him away from you by his hair this morning. The landlord came the day before yesterday to make a row. You've mixed it up." "Stay, I really have mixed it up. Perhaps it was you. Why dispute about trifles? What does it matter to him who it is gives him a beating?" She laughed. "Come along," Shatov pulled me. "The gate's creaking, he'll find us and beat her." And before we had time to run out onto the stairs, we heard a drunken shout and a shower of oaths at the gate. Shatov let me into his room and locked the door. "You'll have to stay a minute if you don't want a scene. He's squealing like a little pig. He must have stumbled over the gate again. He falls flat every time." We didn't get off without a scene, however. Section 6. Shatov stood at the closed door of his room and listened. Suddenly he sprang back. "He's coming here. I knew he would," he whispered furiously. "Now there'll be no getting rid of him till midnight." Several violent thumps of a fist on the door followed. "Shatov, Shatov, open!" yelled the captain. "Shatov, friend! I have come to thee to tell thee that the sun doth rise apace, that the forest glows and trembles in the fire of his embrace. Tell thee I have waked, God damn thee, wakened under the birch twigs." "As it might be under the birch rods, ha-ha. Every little bird is thirsty, says I'm going to have a drink, but I don't know what to drink." Oh, damn his stupid curiosity. "Shatov, do you understand how good it is to be alive?" "Don't answer," Shatov whispered to me again. "Open the door. Do you understand that there's something higher than brawling in mankind? There are moments of honorable man. Shatov, I'm good. I'll forgive you. Shatov, damn the manifestos, eh?" Silence. "Do you understand, you ass, that I'm in love, that I've bought a dress coat? Look, the garb of love, 15 rubles. A captain's love calls for the niceties of style. Open the door!" he roared savagely all of a sudden, and he began furiously banging with his fists again. "Go to hell!" Shatov roared suddenly. "Slave! Bond slave, and your sister's a slave, a bondswoman, a thief! And you sold your sister!" "That's a lie. I put up with the libel, though. I could with one word. Do you understand what she is?" "What?" Shatov at once drew near the door inquisitively. "But will you understand?" "Yes, I shall understand. Tell me what." "I'm not afraid to say. I'm never afraid to say anything in public." "You? Not afraid? A likely story," said Shatov, taunting him and nodding to me to listen. "Me afraid?" "Yes, I think you are." "Me afraid? Well, then, tell away if you're not afraid of your master's whip. You're a coward, though you are a captain."
She's
faltered Lebyadkin in a voice shaking with excitement. "Well?" Shatov put his ear to the door. A silence followed, lasting at least half a minute. "Scoundrel!" came from the other side of the door at last, and the captain hurriedly beat a retreat downstairs, puffing like a samovar. stumbling on every step. "Yes, he's a sly one, and won't give himself away even when he's drunk." Shatov moved away from the door. "What's it all about?" I asked. Shatov waved aside the question, opened the door, and began listening on the stairs again. He listened a long while, and even stealthily descended a few steps. At last he came back. "There's nothing to be heard. He isn't beating her. He must have flopped down at once to go to sleep. It's time for you to go." "Listen, Shatov, what am I to gather from all this?" "Oh, gather what you like," he answered in a weary and disgusted voice, and he sat down to his writing-table. I went away. An improbable idea was growing stronger and stronger in my mind. I thought of the next day with distress. End of chapter 4, section 6. Recording by Expatriate in Bangor, Maine.